service.
Disgraceland is brought to you by Disgraceland All Access. Disgraceland All Access membership is your chance to support the show and get ad-free listening, an exclusive scripted episode every month, and exclusive bonus content every week, plus access to an always-on chat with me and your fellow discos. Visit disgracelandpod.com/membership or just click on the link in the show notes for this episode.
Disgraceland is a production of Double Elvis.
The stories about Lynyrd Skynyrd are insane. Their singer, Ronnie Van Zant, was a violent bully from the mean streets of Jacksonville, Florida. He tried to maim one of his guitar player's hands with a broken bottle. He knocked out his piano player's front teeth not once, but twice. He held a gun to his drummer's head during rehearsal. And when his bandmates followed suit with their own debauched antics, Ronnie turned their drug and alcohol flirtations with death to hit songs. Great songs. Some of the best and most enduring American rock and roll songs of all time. Unlike that music I played for you at the top of the show. That wasn't great music. That was a preset loop from my Mellotron called You Can Call Me Betty, MK1. I played you that loop because I can't afford the rights to You Light Up My Life by Debbie Boone. And why would I play you that specific slice of Pining by the Window cheese? Could I afford it? Because that was the number one song in America on October 20th, 1977. And that was the day that Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane dropped from the sky and crashed into a Mississippi swamp, killing six passengers, including Ronnie Van Zant. On this episode, busted teeth, broken bottles, pining by the window cheese, and Lynyrd Skynyrd. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Disgraceland. Lynyrd Skynyrd's drummer, Artemus Pyle, was covered in blood. He dragged his battered body through the swamp. His ribs felt like they were shattered. Just like that Convair CV-240 was shattered into God knows how many pieces when it dropped out of the sky and crash-landed here. Wherever here was. South Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana. The plane wasn't in the air too long before it all went to shit. Now that two-bit death trap was smoldering on the swamp floor. The members of Lynyrd Skynyrd and their entourage were dying or already dead. When Pyle managed to pull himself out of the destruction, he saw the pilot and the co-pilot still strapped into their cockpit seats, hanging upside down from a tree. You didn't have to look twice to know they were no longer of this earth. But what about everybody else? Pyle had no idea. Ronnie Van Zant, Lynyrd Skynyrd's lead singer and resident ass-kicker, hated flying. How's that for a bad omen? There were others, too. The Convair was 30 years old. It looked like something the fucking Clampets would tool around in. Aerosmith straight up refused when they were offered to fly in it. And just yesterday, flying from Miami to Greenville, South Carolina, a 10-foot fireball shot out of the engine at 12,000 feet in the air. Burned for a minute. Easy. They all saw it. And that was textbook fucking biblical guidance. You get through this flight, you touch down, you kiss the ground, you thank the Lord, and you do not get back on that plane. And why was Lynyrd Skynyrd in this position in the first place? They were huge. Like, blow the Rolling Stones off the stage at Nebworth huge. About to headline Madison Square Garden huge. And as such, they should enjoy the luxuries that a huge band can afford. Like their manager. And that fucker was sitting in first class right now, on some commercial flight, while his boys sweated it out in this hunk of junk. What's their name? Everybody knew their name. This wasn't the early 70s anymore. It was October 20th, 1977. Just 3 days earlier, Lynyrd Skynyrd released their fourth studio album, Street Survivors. The critics even liked it, and the fans liked it too. They were a big deal. The pilots, on the other hand, had acted like yesterday's 10-foot fireball wasn't a big deal. Ronnie followed suit. That was probably just his confrontational machismo trumping his aviation phobia. That dude was born fists first. That's what they said, at least. He fought anyone and anything, even his bandmates. Ronnie Van Zant wasn't going to let some puddle jumper scare the bejesus out of him. Besides, the plan was to have the plane serviced when they reached their next destination, Baton Rouge. But they never made it to Baton Rouge. Up in the air, the right engine sputtered, and then it just died. The pilots were surprised to notice that they were dangerously low on gas, since they had just fueled up in Greenville. They decided to find the closest airport for an emergency landing. They began a slow descent. Landing with one working engine probably would have worked, if that is, the left engine didn't give out too, which it did. The pilot walked back to the cabin and made the announcement. "We're out of gas. Put your heads between your legs and buckle up tight." Artemis Pyle replayed that moment through his head as he continued to drag his ass through the swamp. The sun had gone down, and the sound of cicadas had gone down with it. And in their place, all Pyle could hear was the rush of wind after the Convair's second engine failed. Then the sound of the wind was replaced by the violent sound of trees hitting the undercarriage as the plane sank lower to the ground. First one tree, then another and another, and suddenly 10, 15, 20 treetops, all smacking the plane at once, and then ripping it apart like beasts disemboweling their prey. Pyle shook the sounds from his head and moved through the swamp. He hadn't always been a drummer. He was ex-Marine. Once a leatherneck, always a leatherneck. Marines didn't give up, and they didn't leave anyone behind. The swamp, on the other hand, had different ideas. The swamp was a sunken tableau of mud and vines and grass and twigs, the dead limbs of mighty oak trees abandoned and forgotten. The low croak of bullfrogs sang their ancient forest ballad. Pyle looked up. Helicopters. That was nice and all, but he didn't have time to wait for the search party to land. He crossed over a creek. Snakes hissed in the muck. At long last, he saw a barbed wire fence up in the distance, and just beyond it, a herd of cattle. Civilization. Pyle hoped to God that someone was home. He slid under the fence and approached the farmhouse. The cows standing in the field gave him blank stares. Not so much for the farmer, who had emerged from his homestead with a shotgun in his hand. He looked at Pyle like he was a blood-soaked, long-haired hippie swamp thing. He saw the copters circling above. He knew there was a prison camp nearby. He put two and two together. He cocked his firearm, raised it, and then he pulled the trigger. It was supposed to be a warning shot, but Artemis Pyle felt the buckshot tear into his shoulder. That sealed it. Pyle knew he wasn't in South Carolina or Mississippi or Louisiana. He didn't need no bullfrog croaking its primordial folktale to tell him where he was. He caught a whiff first of gunpowder and then of hot metal charring his flesh. Can you smell that smell? Destruction. Death. Hell.
Hey guys, I want to talk to you about my Tecovas cowboy boots. I picked them up while I was in Austin, Texas. I had this event I had to go to that night. It was a formal thing. I had this idea of what I was going to wear, but I needed the one extra thing. And I was like, aha, Tecovas. There's a Tecovas here in Austin. The dudes who worked at the store were great. I found the exact boot I was looking for. This boot is called the Dylan. I got it in midnight black. I wore them to this formal event. I had on a suit. And then tonight, I'm going to wear them with jeans to my son's baseball game. These things are amazing cowboy boots. They're super comfortable, and I can tell already that they're going to last for a long time. A couple things you can do here to check out Tecovas. If you can, stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two. The experience is awesome. You can shop all the new styles. You're going to smell that fresh leather in the store. The friendly staff are going to be at your service. They're going to take care of you. They're going to make you feel like a rock star. A lot of the Tecovas stores have these leather custom branding services to make your boots truly personalized. They put on regular live music and events. It's an awesome in-store experience. So if you have the opportunity to check out a Tecovas store, I highly recommend it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges, and they ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today. Hey, Discos, it's Jake here. Thank you so much for listening to Disgraceland. Your support truly means a lot to me, and it's because of you that my team and I are able to make this show. If you want more Disgraceland, if you want more regular interactions with me and the community of Disgraceland listeners, or if you simply want to listen to the show ad-free, go to disgracelandpod.com/membership or just click on the link in the show notes for this episode. For just $5 a month, you can listen to every episode of Disgraceland ad-free. Plus, you'll get one brand new exclusive episode every month. You'll also get weekly unscripted bonus content, special audio collections, and early access to merch and events. There are two ways that you can support the show and become a member at disgracelandpod.com/membership. You can sign up using Patreon and listen to the show ad-free on Apple, Spotify, and most other major podcast platforms. And Patreon members also get access to all the other perks of membership and an always-on chat where I'll be interacting with you and diving deeper into the world of Disgraceland. But maybe you're currently an Apple Podcast subscription listener and you want to just tap into all the bonus audio content and ad-free listening that we're offering. We're also offering this membership as a premium channel on Apple Podcasts. However you choose to join, all you got to do is go to disgracelandpod.com/membership. Support the show for just $5 a month, $5, or sign up for an annual plan and get 2 months free. Come join me and your fellow discos at Disgraceland All Access by visiting disgracelandpod.com/membership. Hey, discos, jumping in here quickly to tell you about a new giveaway that we put together especially for Disgraceland fans. Listen to this. We teamed up with our friends at Tivoli Audio and D'Angelico Guitar, two legendary brands in audio, to award one of you a prize pack that includes the all-new Tivoli Audio Songbook paired with a limited edition D'Angelico electric guitar. The Songbook is an incredible vintage-inspired sound system, and you can plug your D'Angelico guitar right into it. It's also got an analog EQ and a 10-hour rechargeable battery so you can take your music and your favorite podcast anywhere. Go to disgracelandcontest.com to see the prize pack and drop your email address to enter for free. Must be a U.S. resident to win. Visit disgracelandcontest.com for full details. That's disgracelandcontest.com. Rock and roll. In 1972, 5 years before their blossoming superstardom was cut short by a fatal plane crash, Lynyrd Skynyrd were big fish in a little pond. The pond was Jacksonville, Florida, a town that wasn't big enough for two shit-hot local bands. Lucky for Skynyrd, Dwayne and Greg had taken the Almonds over to Macon. Skynyrd stuck around. They made an impression. Whether they were calling themselves Conqueror Worm or the Noble Five, the 1%, or Sons of Satan, the name they eventually settled on endeared them to a particular subset of Jacksonville denizens. Those long-haired hippie types whose very appearance made the old-school rednecks nervous. Lynyrd Skynyrd was a real person, a high school gym teacher at, yes, Robert E. Lee High School. He got soon-to-be Skynyrd guitarist Gary Rossington suspended because Gary's hair touched his shirt collar and fell within 2 fingers of his eyebrows, thus violating the high-and-tight dress code. But it wasn't just their long hair and fuck the man sense of humor that got Skynyrd notice. They could fucking play. They played so damn well that Alan Walden, formerly of Capricorn Records, picked them over the 186 other bands he auditioned in the course of 1 year and signed them to a management contract. They played so well that Al Kooper, Bob Dylan's rock and roll Zelig, signed them to his brand new MCA Records imprint called Sounds of the South after witnessing them kill at a small club. But if they ever wanted to make it outside the greater Jacksonville area, they needed more original songs. So they rented a one-room shack some 30 miles outside of town to write and rehearse. No AC. And if the heat didn't kill you, then maybe the gators and cottonmouths would. They called it Hell House. It wasn't just the heat that made the cabin feel like purgatory. Ronnie Van Zant was a take-no-shit taskmaster. Practice was 9 a.m. to dusk every day. No entourage, no girls. You played the song, and then you played it again. You fucked up the intro, stop, do it again. You played the solo different than last time, stop, do it again.
Leon Wilkerson's bass had to be married to Bob Burns' kick drum, and the guitar onslaught of Gary Rossington, Alan Collins, and Ed King, the triple threat they dubbed the Guitar Army, that had to be assassin-level precise. Leave the shroom shit to the almonds. Jammin' wasn't Skynyrd's cross to bear. Skynyrd was tight. Skynyrd live sounded just like Skynyrd on record. Even their show-stopping ballad turned Barn Burner, Free Bird, the Stairway to Heaven of the South. That song was mathematically precise every time they played it. You could cut glass with that tune. And that was all because Ronnie Van Zant held Skynyrd's feet to the Hell House fire. Now After Hours was when Ronnie switched gears and lived what he called the rock gut life. The rock gut life was bottomless bottles of scotch, broken noses, and busted fists. It was when the booze did the talking for you. It did the fighting, too. Ronnie Van Zant wasn't just a street survivor from a poor neighborhood. He was a street fighter. There didn't have to be a reason why he fought. Maybe a guy looked at him the wrong way on the sidewalk. Maybe a guy didn't look at him at all. Didn't fucking matter. You wanted to exit the room with all your teeth, right? So first you had to figure out how you were going to get past Ronnie Van Zant. Ronnie's own mother thought he was the meanest son of a bitch in town, but, you know, moms are biased like that. And though Ronnie Van Zant may have been, as his heroes the Rolling Stones sang about, a street-fighting man, he was not, to paraphrase a Skynyrd song, a simple kind of man. Ronnie was complicated. Ronnie could write a song like The Needle and the Spoon, a cautionary tale about heroin, while still dabbling in stuff that was way harder than Chivas Regal. Ronnie could write a song like Sweet Home Alabama, a Southern man's proud battle cry, shit-talking Canadian liberals be damned, and do it while not only claiming that the divisive Confederate flag hoisted at Skynyrd shows in the mid-70s was not his idea but merely a marketing gimmick by MCA Records, but also by loving the hell out of a certain Canadian liberal, Mr. Neil Young, the one who had dissed Southern men not once but twice in his own songs. Ronnie did, as it turns out, need Mr. Young around, but I digress, and more on that age-old beef later. Ronnie Van Zant could even champion gun control in a song like Saturday Night Special, while simultaneously putting the fear of God into his bandmates with a loaded pistol. Bob Burns, Lynyrd Skynyrd's original drummer, was burning up inside Hell House. Ronnie was cracking the whip again. Bob just wanted to be done. Ronnie didn't care what Bob did or didn't want. Lynyrd Skynyrd weren't going to grab that big brass ring by quitting when they were tired. As bassist Leon Wilkerson once said, Ronnie ran Skynyrd like Stalin ran Russia. The Saturday Night Special came out fast, barrel blue and cold. Ronnie stuck it against Bob's temple. Play the motherfucking song, Ronnie said, or I'm going to blow your brains all over this room. Bob and the rest of the band feared Ronnie even more than they loved and respected him. They did what Ronnie said. That was the only path. It was a path of destruction. At first, Skynyrd destroyed the bands they opened up for. They could fuck up the competition just by showing up. Ask the band that was playing at Greenfield Stables when Skynyrd's van arrived on site. Fans screamed and cheered so loudly for Skynyrd that they drowned out the music being played on stage. Do you know who that band was? Neither do I. No one remembers them, but everyone remembered Lynyrd Skynyrd, for better or for worse. 1973, Daly City, California. Keith Moon was drunk. Or maybe it was the pills, the ones meant to knock out a horse or put an elephant on its ass. Either way, Keith was sprawled out backstage at the Cow Palace. He could barely sit up straight, let alone play. And the other members of the Who quickly came to a solution. The drummer for the opening band could fill in. That was easier said than done. Playing or partying, Lynyrd Skynyrd went toe-to-toe. There were also quick studies. Touring with The Who would prove to be their big break. A serious promotion from playing to audience of 1,000 on a good night to 19,000 every night. But it also proved to be the moment where Ronnie Van Zant's rock gut life bled over into band life. Were you playing or fighting? It was hard to tell the difference while you were busy setting a new pace. The Who plays loud, you play louder. Keith Moon gets drunk, you get drunker. Which explains why Skynyrd's drummer, Bob Burns, did not fill in for Mooney that evening, because just like his British counterpart, Bob Burns was plastered. Instead, some 19-year-old got the dream gig of a lifetime when he was hauled from the crowd to sit in with one of the biggest bands on the planet. Skynyrd could relate to the luck of the 19-year-old kid. Thanks to the connections of their producer, Al Kooper, they were opening for The Who. and thanks to The Who, they now have the attention of audiences beyond Jacksonville. This coming on the heels of a hit debut album pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, which peaked at number 27 on the Billboard album chart. It felt like the beginning of a new chapter. For Bob Burns, however, it was the beginning of the end. The next year, 1974, on tour in England, Bob Burns saw the devil. It stared at him from behind the eyes of a hotel owner's cat. The thing was possessed, and it had to die. Bob grabbed the cat, made his way to the top floor of the hotel, tossed it out a window. They say a cat always lands on its feet. This is not true. This cat died on impact. The devil, on the other hand, wouldn't be killed off so easily. Pretty soon he was back, this time in the eyes of Skynyrd's road manager. Bob knew it. He looked into those eyes and trembled. Once again, he knew what he had to do. He had to cast out Satan with extreme prejudice and Ronnie Van Zant caliber violence. But although Bob Burns tanked up on codeine-laced whiskey and chased the guy down the street with a pickaxe, he never caught up with him. Life on the road, on the other hand, life with Ronnie, the rock gut life, that caught up with Bob real fucking quick. And so Bob Burns spiraled out of control and right out of Lynyrd Skynyrd, fast. Not Ronnie Van Zant. Ronnie was going to take his time, go down slow at first and then pick up speed, like a Convair CV240 with two busted engines dropping from the sky. And he was going to take the whole band down with him.
We'll be right back after this
word.
Years before it became drunken shorthand for hecklers at concerts, Freebird was a cathartic finale at Lynyrd Skynyrd's live shows. It had everything. The sensitive part that you swayed to while holding your lighter in the air. And the double-time guitar army climax that left your face melted. And though it ran 9 minutes long, Freebird was a staple of 1970s rock radio. Thanks to the AOR, or album-oriented rock radio format, where DJs on the FM dial were keen to play any and all album tracks they deemed worthy. MCA, however, wouldn't release Freebird as a single. And why would they? The song single-handedly made Skynyrd's debut album a massive commercial success. It wasn't until November of 1974, more than a year after the album was released, that Freebird was finally released as a single. By that time, Skynyrd's sophomore album, Second Helping, was already on shelves, and one of that album's singles was making waves for entirely different reasons. Ronnie Van Zant and Skynyrd guitarists Ed King and Gary Rossington wrote Sweet Home Alabama in response to the song Southern Man in Alabama, both by Neil Young, both unflinching portraits of deep-seated racism in the Deep South. Ronnie was proud of his Southern heritage. He wasn't a dumb redneck. He didn't think it was fair for Neil to lump all Southerners together as bigots. So he called out Neil Young by name in what would become Skynyrd's highest charting single. But it was the song's other call-out that attracted more controversy. George Wallace, the Alabama governor who championed a Jim Crow South in the middle of the civil rights movement, the guy known for lines like segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, he got his own moment in Sweet Home Alabama. But was it Skynyrd saluting or lampooning the infamous politician? Ronnie gave an interview in the mid-70s where he called the song a joke, but then went on to call Wallace a gentleman with a lot of nerve and balls. Ed King was less coy when it came to the band's politics. Ronnie was a big fan of George Wallace, he later said. He totally supported him. We all did. We respected the way Wallace stood up for the South. Anybody who tells you differently is lying. Ronnie's supposed beef with Neil Young wasn't a lie exactly. It was an opportunity to rally Skynyrd's base. It was good for business. But off the record, even after the Sweet Home Alabama dust-up, Ronnie regularly wore Neil Young t-shirts in concert. He even wore one on the cover of the Street Survivors album. And Neil passed on his home demos to Skynyrd. He wanted them to record his song Powderfinger on an upcoming record. They never got around to it. Which meant the existing narrative, the one that lived and breathed on the airwaves, carried on their fictionalized riff for decades, still does today. But this is the real story. Neil Young loved Ronnie Van Zant, and Ronnie Van Zant loved Neil Young. Ed King, on the other hand, didn't feel Ronnie Van Zant's love. All Ed King felt was Ronnie Van Zant's Wrath. Ronnie bitched and moaned about Ed's playing, over and over. Ed was garage rock royalty, former member of the Strawberry Alarm Clock, co-writer of the number one hit Incense and Peppermints. That was a nugget if you dug it, but Ed never got that respect. There was a pecking order in Skinner. Ronnie Van Zant was on top. Everyone else was down below. The abuse was verbal. The abuse was physical. Ed King couldn't take it. He didn't see the devil like Bob Burns did, but he saw the writing on the wall all the same. In 1975, a year in which Ronnie was arrested no less than 5 times for being shit-faced, Skinner embarked on a 90-day, 61-show tour to support their third album, Nothing Fancy. They called it the Torture Tour. The tour was aptly named. Ronnie berated Ed backstage after a show in Pittsburgh. Ed bounced back to his hotel room where he packed his shit and left in the middle of the night. He never came back. He didn't know it then, but Ed King got out while the getting was good. Not so much for Billy Powell, the band's piano player. Billy made the unfortunate decision of arguing with Skinner's road manager in a hallway directly outside Ronnie's hotel room. Ronnie opened the door and told him to cut the shit. Billy told Ronnie to mind his own fucking business. Ronnie punched Billy square in the mouth. Billy stumbled back. He tasted blood as it rushed from his lip, and then he felt his 2 front teeth bouncing around in his mouth. Just a week later, at the tour's closing date in Jacksonville, it was Ronnie's turn to taste blood. He started coughing just a few songs into the set and tasted warm iron in his mouth. All that singing from the throat and not from the gut. They cut the show short. The audience rioted. They tossed bottles. They fucked up Skinner's gear. Police drew their revolvers. Kids got their arms chewed up by canines. 16 people were arrested. Ronnie's street-fighting rock gut life manifested itself by osmosis. Backstage, Ronnie needed something for the riot in his throat. Something to make the pain go away. Pills, coke, booze, something stronger. Something. Anything. The peppermint schnapps tasted good on ice. It wasn't like bourbon or scotch. It went down real easy. The boys and Lynyrd Skynyrd ordered another round, and then another. Conversation turned. What the hell even was schnapps, and how did you say that word? Schnapps, schnapps, schnopes, schnapps. Schnapps, right? Schnapps. Ronnie Van Zant wasn't amused. The more he drank, the more he wasn't the lead singer of one of the biggest bands in the world anymore. He was the neighborhood bully. You pronounce it schnapps, you dumb fuck, like shut up and stop, smooshed together. Fucking idiot saying words all wrong and shit. That's Ronnie, by the way, not me. So the band got back to their hotel room, and they were pissed off, and Ronnie was still pissed too. So he did what he always did when he was pissed. He started swinging his fists around. The guys told him to cool it. And that just made him angrier. Ronnie grabbed a bottle and smashed it. Then he waved around a jagged piece of glass clutched in his fist. Someone was gonna get fucked up tonight. Gary Rossington would do. I'm gonna cut your hands, Ronnie said to Gary. You're not gonna play guitar again. Ronnie slashed. The glass cut open Gary's hand. Ronnie slashed again. Sliced Gary's other hand. Again and again and again. Slash, slice, slash, slice. Until Gary's hands were chopped to hell. And the blood was everywhere. Skinner's road manager took care of the whole thing like he always did. He had a briefcase stocked with $250,000 in cash just for shit like this. Bail money, hush money, blood and glass on hotel room carpet floor money. But although money mended Gary's hands, throwing money at a problem didn't always fix it. And the problems kept coming. Not just Ronnie's problems. The crew got into it with some asshole who wouldn't stop running his mouth at the bar one night. Words turned to elbows in the face, which then turned into Skynyrd getting tossed out on the street. And that incident was immortalized in the Lynyrd Skynyrd song, What's Your Name? The lead-off track to the album Street Survivors, released in October of 1977. That album also featured the song That Smell, partly inspired by Gary, fucked up on Quaaludes and booze when he drove his brand new Ford Torino at high speed through a telephone pole, then a parked car, an oak tree, and finally into a house. No wait, it wasn't Gary who hit the parked car. That was another Skinner guitarist, Alan Collins, when he got into it in his own automobile wreck. Ronnie used Gary and Alan's car accidents as inspiration for the cautionary tale that was That Smell. You know, do as us Skinner boys say, not as we do. Still, can you imagine the guy who gets so fucked up that he carves up your hands with a broken bottle, hands that you use to make your living in his band, or he knocks out your teeth in a hotel hallway, which, for the record, was not the last time Ronnie punched out the piano player's teeth.
That's the same guy who comes to your hospital room, gives you a guilt trip for crashing your car, and then writes a fucking song about it. I got a word for a guy like that. Asshole. Lynyrd Skynyrd had a song for everything, though, it seemed. Bar fights, car crashes, guns, drugs. They even wrote their own eulogy. They just didn't know it yet. Artemis Pyle's shoulder burned from where the buckshot had hit him. He held up his hands in the air as the farmer reloaded. "Don't shoot!" he yelled, and then he desperately told the farmer who he was and what had happened. By the time rescue crews arrived on the evening of October 20th, 1977, at the site of Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane crash near Gillsburg, Mississippi, a stretch of tree-lined swamp called Slaughterhouse Road, the bone pickers were already picking up on that smell. Not just the smell of death, but of morbid opportunity. They picked up wallets, purses, cash, jewelry. All of it stolen while 20 survivors lay there bleeding. Like Gary Rosington, one leg and both arms broken, his stomach and liver punctured. And Billy Powell, whose facial lacerations were so severe, his nose was hanging off his face. And the band's security chief, Gene Odom, blind in one eye with a broken neck, whose final words to the pilots before the crash were, "I hope you two sons of bitches live through this so I can kill you both." Gene Odom didn't get to carry out his threat. The pilot and co-pilot were both dead, hanging from their cockpit seat upside down in a tree. Steve Gaines, the guitarist who had replaced Ed King just the year before, and his sister Casey, one of Skynyrd's new backup singers, were also among the dead, as was Skynyrd's tour manager, and Ronnie Van Zant, who was not in his seat at the time of the crash, but was passed out on the cabin floor, either from a stiff drink, a sedative, or both. He died from blunt force trauma to his forehead, most likely from a tree limb that thrust through a window during that harrowing descent into the Mississippi tree line. Other details of the crash were as ambiguous as Ronnie's lyrics. The National Travel Safety Bureau's official report ruled the crash was caused by, quote, "fuel exhaustion and total loss of power from both engines due to crew inattention to fuel supply," unquote. In other words, the plane burned through gas at an abnormally high rate and the pilots failed to notice it until it was too late. Still, to some, it sure was convenient that Peter Rudge, Skynyrd's manager since Alan Walden left in 1974, chose to ride first class on a commercial plane instead of in a leased Corvair with the rest of the boys. Others grasped for clues on the cover of Street Survivors, Skynyrd's final album with Ronnie Van Zant in their original lineup, released just days before the crash. The cover showed the band standing on a street surrounded by flames, as if they were making a defiant stand in hell itself. The photograph was said to be prophetic, that the members touched by flames in the photo were the ones to perish in the crash. Closer inspection of the cover showed that actually all members of the band were touched by the flames in one way or another. Nevertheless, MCA pulled the original cover and replaced it with a similar shot of the band standing in utter darkness, illuminated only by a spotlight. And in that darkness, they remained. Lynyrd Skynyrd disbanded, but the crash wasn't the end of their suffering. The swamp, the darkness, the devil, hell, none of that was through with them yet. In the aftermath of the tragedy, one roadie took his own life. Another was institutionalized. Guitarist Alan Collins lost his wife in childbirth and then, years later, lost his girlfriend when he crashed his Ford Thunderbird into a ditch. The accident left Alan paralyzed from the chest down. Surviving band members argued and sued each other, largely over Lynyrd Skynyrd's legacy. Many of them had it out for their manager, Peter Rudge, the one who leased the plane but refused to ride in it. As a result, Rudge nearly killed himself with cocaine and alcohol. And after a 10-year hiatus, Lynyrd Skynyrd returned, but they were never the same. Lynyrd Skynyrd 2.0 has been around for decades now, far longer than the original lineup ever was. Ronnie's younger brother Johnny is the band's lead vocalist, not to be confused with the third Van Zant brother, Donnie, former lead singer for 38 Special. Gary Rossington remains the band's only original member.
If you're seeing Lynyrd Skynyrd these days, you're watching a glorified tribute band. All the things that made Lynyrd Skynyrd, for better or worse, the mystery, the danger, the violence, all of that either got left at the bottom of a Mississippi swamp or was put 6 feet in a hole. June 29th, 2000. Jacksonville Memory Garden Cemetery, 3 a.m. Clay County Sheriff's deputies responding to a disturbance were shocked at what they found. Someone had robbed the graves of Steve Gaines and Ronnie Van Zandt. Near the smashed marble mausoleums, a plastic bag containing Steve Gaines' ashes was on the ground. Next to it was Ronnie's casket, which had been wrestled from its tomb. The vandals either weren't able to pry open the casket, or they got spooked and ran off before they could do further damage. The cops didn't have any leads. For more than 22 years, the final resting place of Steve Gaines and Ronnie Van Zandt had been a mecca for Skynyrd fans to pay their respects. Not just to the memory of those two men, but to the memory of Lynyrd Skynyrd, which for all intents and purposes died in that Mississippi swamp back in 1977. And for more than 22 years, visitors treated the grounds with respect. But not on this night. The families were horrified. They moved the remains of Steve Gaines and Ronnie Van Zandt to an undisclosed private location where they could carry out eternity in peace. And why would someone do such a thing? Dig up a grave? Did they do it for no other reason than to just do it? Just like Ronnie Van Zandt didn't need a reason to fight. Or was it something else? Were the vandals hoping to confirm one final long-standing rumor? Was Ronnie Van Zandt really buried wearing his Neil Young t-shirt? Can't you smell that smell? Destruction. Death. Disgrace. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Disgraceland. Disgraceland was created by yours truly and is produced in partnership with Double Elvis. Credits for this episode can be found on the show notes page at disgracelandpod.com. If you're listening as a Disgraceland All Access member, thank you for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. And if not, you can become a member right now by going to disgracelandpod.com/membership. Members can listen to every episode of Disgraceland ad-free. Plus, you'll get one brand new exclusive episode every month, weekly unscripted bonus episodes, special audio collections, and early access to merchandise and events. Visit disgracelandpod.com/membership for details. Rate and review the show and follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and Facebook at disgracelandpod and on YouTube at youtube.com/@disgracelandpod. Rock-a-rolla.
He's a bad, bad man.